Another Christmas dilemma, I suppose, as we move towards Christmas, the food gets richer and richer and all kinds of rich booze thrown on top of it. So how is all this indulgence for our poor old gut? Well, Fergus Shanahan, gastroenterologist and emeritus professor of medicine in UCC, joins me now. Good afternoon, Fergus.
Hello, Brendan.
Now, Fergus, we are all obsessed with our gut health these days, and we'll talk about the generalities of minding our microbiomes and all that. But just on Christmas, not a good time for the gut, I imagine, is it?
Well, gastroenterologists will tell you that January is a very busy time for gastroenterologists, and figures for the sales of all kinds of remedies, including antacids, tend to skyrocket in January. And there's a reason for it, because we change our eating pattern, obviously, at Christmas time. We increase the amount we eat. We're already overweight, and we tip the balance. We increase that a little bit more. But the pattern of our eating changes. We tend to eat at different times. We have snacks at times we wouldn't otherwise have. We take different things. We take mulled wine. We take mince pies. We take all kinds of things that we wouldn't normally have. And in addition to the great increase in diversity of what we're taking very, very rich foods that we wouldn't normally have. And in Ireland, Christmas seems to go on forever. We take it over quite a prolonged time. And what gastroenterologists frequently see in January is people complaining of words like indigestion, dyspepsia, a heaviness in their abdomen. What they're describing, actually, and could be all the way up to heartburn, but what they're describing is really esophageal reflux, the reflux of acid and food contents from the stomach back up into the esophagus because of all this.
Okay, so would a simple tip there be like don't lie down after the Christmas dinner?
It wouldn't be a bad tip, actually. Another tip might be careful about all the little extra things we take after the big meal. Okay. Like, for example, people like to take the minced, peppermint. Chocolate peppermints, and one of the products actually tells you you probably should be taking it after 8 or 9 o'clock at night, when you shouldn't be taking that before you're about to go to bed. But peppermint particularly, and chocolate, will relax the valve at the lower end of the esophagus. That's an area of high pressure that kind of protects you. But peppermint is very potent at relaxing smooth muscle and will leave that valve wide open. And then, of course, you might get into a semi-recumbent position with your legs up watching the television.
Okay.
Maybe a bit sozzled from the mulled wine. And then you go off to bed and you lie flat and you have all that stuff that you put into your stomach swishing over the esophagus and it gets inflamed.
Okay, so any kind of peppermint patty, not a good digestive. Okay, so now, in general, It's all about having a healthy microbiome. Let's go over the basics for people who don't know. What is the microbiome? Why is it important?
Well, the microbiome is just a general word for all of the living little creatures that are on your body and in your body, in almost all your body cavities, but most of them are in your gut, your stomach, your intestine, and your colon, your large bowel. And they include bacteria, they include fungi, and they include viruses. And we need them. They are part of what we are. We acquire them at birth from our mothers generally, and then we acquire them from the immediate environment, including our diet, as we in postnatal life. But they are primarily a health asset. Animals who are born without any microbes, that can be done experimentally, are not healthy animals. They can survive all right, but they're not healthy. So the microbes educate our immune system and teach the immune system how to distinguish something that's dangerous in the environment from something that's not dangerous and innocuous.
Okay.
The microbes also, by the way, help our digestion. They help our metabolism. They even help, they're important for the development of pretty much all internal organs, including the brain.
Yeah, and I know you do a lot of work down in UCC, don't you, on the gut brain and the notion of the gut as the second brain. And that, like, the microbiome can affect mood and depression and all kinds of things, can't it?
Yes, it has an influence. Most of the work has been done in animals, less so in humans. But the emerging evidence is that all organs are talking to the brain, all organs are sending signals to the brain. But now that we know that there's, if you like, an organ within an organ, that is the microbes, if you were to look at all their metabolic behavior and all the chemicals they're producing, it would be something the equivalent of the liver. It's like it's a hidden organ, if you like, inside in our gut. So that's signaling the brain all the time. The brain is interpreting that. and controlling what's happening in the gut. I mean, I think the gut, which has been much maligned in by poets and writers and great thinkers in history, but the gut to me is the emperor of all organs. If you think about it, Brendan, it's a fabulous majesty of an organ. We have to actually move all the stuff we consume from mouth all the way down to anus. The distance there is something up to the order of maybe 29 feet. That's the size of an Olympic long jump. Wow. And if you imagine like the Dublin Port Tunnel or something, you know, if that were designed like the human gut, we'd never have breakdowns. We'd never have ongoing repairs. We'd never have traffic jams. Think about what happens when you actually consume food. In health, we're never really conscious of our gut. It's a remarkable achievement that all this stuff we put in health, we're only aware of it when we want to put something into it and when we want to evacuate it. And apart from the odd gurgle, we don't really think about our gut. Mm. And yet that had to be achieved by passing all this material down through the gut, where the gut has to decide what's healthy, what do I want to absorb, what do I not want to absorb, what will I excrete? And passage all that down, measuring and assessing the temperature, the osmolarity of it, the consistency of it, the taste of it, all these receptors, it has to be all fed back to one central regulator. And that's why the gut is so connected with the brain.
I think that's one of the finest homages to the gut I've heard on modern radio, I have to say. It's practically poetic, Fergus. The thing is, one thing I would disagree with you on is you say we don't think about the gut. There is a bit of an obsession in the culture now with the gut. And there is a lot of, there's a lot of kind of various services, gut testing and testing out your microbes and all that kind of thing. How do we know if we have a healthy gut or not?
Well, I'm glad if there's a bit of an obsession because, you know, there's a huge Irish dimension to this. In Cork, we had the first microbiome centre in the world, actually. We started at the time of the Human Genome Project. So we've been at it for 20 to 30 years, beating and barking about it. So I'm glad you're hearing about it now. So with regard to someone just saying, look, I'd like to see, or how's my gut microbiome, or will I get a test? I always tell people to be very careful about this. Because what are you measuring? A single isolated test in an individual, if you're just curious, I recommend against that. I do recommend you do things that promote health in your gut. But a single isolated test is wide open for exploitation. There are numerous people who will charge you a lot of money for the thing. And what are you actually going to do? What are you going to actually find? What are you looking for? Unless there's a specific question, I don't actually advise people to do it if it's not in the context of a research study.
Okay.
And the science is not at the stage yet where I could say, Brendan, the ideal microbiome for you is this, these particular organisms, and the ideal microbiome for Fergus Shanahan is something else. We're not quite at that level. We can paint in broad brush strokes about what's generally good, what's generally bad. And work actually in Ireland has challenged the concept of what's a normal microbiome in a multicultural society. For example, around the world are two broad types of microbiome. One would be the ancient ancestral ones that you see in non-industrialized developing countries, such as Tibet, Mongolia, Peruvian farmers, and the Hadza hunter-gatherers in Tanzania. And then most microbiome studies have been done in the Western world. And we, for example, in Ireland are a developed country. We are a bit like the British, we're a bit like the Americans, the Canadians. Our microbiome is not terribly dissimilar from those, but very dissimilar from the ancient microbiomes. And yet we found in Cork a marvelous study that showed that the Irish travelers, they have a microbiome far more akin to the ancient microbiomes. So, for example, what's normal for me versus what's normal for an Irish traveller? They're two very distinct microbiomes. So a single isolated test done outside that context wouldn't be able to tell you which is good and which is bad.
Yeah, okay. Now, so then you're saying we should just be trying to do things that are good for the gut.
Yes.
So tell us what we should be doing.
Okay, well, stop abusing the gut. The gut will do fine if we stop abusing it. The first form of abuse, which is introduced into society, was injudicious use of antibiotics, broad-spectrum antibiotics, which we've had now since the 1940s.
Yeah, Fergus, I just interrupted you there because I have a text here from a man. My spleen was removed some years ago. I've been on two daily antibiotics a day since. I feel like it's impacting my overall health, but I'm an older man, so I must do what I'm told. Does your expert have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, unfortunately, we can't all just avoid antibiotics. That individual is a good example. It's not a complete knockout punch, but continual exposure to broad-spectrum antibiotics will protect you from certain infections, but sadly, unfortunately, it will actually inhibit the favorable, the beneficial organisms, microbes that are in your gut. That individual will have to do something else, and the best strategy there to try and promote healthy microbiome is probably diet.
Okay.
And it's more simple than complex. It doesn't need highly sophisticated chemical analysis or anything like that. They're simple broad brush strokes. And the first word would be diversification, to okay. broaden your diet. Because when you're eating, you're not just feeding yourself, Brendan, you're feeding your microbes. And if you don't feed them, you lose them and you can't get them back.
Okay. So basically, without getting into too much of it, you're eating right across the spectrum of food. But would there be a focus on fiber?
Yes.
Yeah.
As natural as you can make it, as close to source as you can make it, as real food as you can make it. And Dennis Burkitt was an Irish surgeon, actually, who popularized the concept of fiber very early on. And anyone who heard him was privileged to hear him speak, would have been thrilled to hear him speak. But unfortunately, he didn't have mechanism at the time. He knew that fiber was important. He didn't have the mechanism, and the work sort of went out of fashion. But now that we know if fiber is really the food for your microbes, and there are different types of fiber. It's not just one thing. There's soluble, there's insoluble fiber. There's a huge development in fiber science that the food industry is getting a hold of now. So again, diversify the types of fibers that you might eat.
Okay, and Fergus, listen, there's loads of questions pouring in, so you'll have to come back on again and maybe just answer questions. Can I ask you before you go, because like I'm a martyr to the gut myself, and we become suckers for anything. There is a load of like over-the-counter kind of probiotic things available out there, and they're quite expensive generally. Are we wasting our time with most of them, or what's the story?
No, you're not. But asking me about, if you say, Fergus, are probiotics good? I'd say, Brendan, that's like asking me, are pills or tablets good for you?
Okay.
You wouldn't take a pill or a tablet from Mrs. Murphy down the road if she was taken for high blood pressure, if you didn't have the high blood pressure. So it depends. There are some very good probiotics that have been scientifically tested that actually work in particular conditions. And the advice to anyone would be, if you feel you have a problem, look at the label. See, is it from a reputable company? Reputable companies will generally have good quality control. There have been a lot of fly-by-night companies that didn't have any kind of decent quality control, much less actually apply any science to what they were doing. But there is science amongst all that snake oil. There are some good, properly, structurally, okay. soundly, scientifically studied, and some of them came from Ireland.
Okay, so do your homework. All right, I'll talk to you again, Fergus, okay? Professor
All right,
Fergus Shanahan, thank you very much.